10. This one, the big one for the afternoon, is the HPA rules update. This is a briefing and a public hearing. We've got the leadership of the Habitat program here to walk us through that. Lisa Venerosa, in one of her final performances before the commission, perhaps we can call this the final performance. Jeff Davis, congratulations on your selection as assistant director. And Randy Thurston, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, commissioners and deputy. We are here, as Madam Chair said, to provide the seventh briefing that you've received on the HPA rule update. We don't intend to repeat the content of the previous six briefings, you'll be happy to hear, for a few reasons, particularly the time constraint, and we want to give as much time as is possible to those stakeholders and entities that came here to talk to you today. So we're going to do our best to limit our overview and briefing to approximately 40 minutes. So what we are going to talk about is three primary categories that we thought would be important for you to hear today as you walk towards your decision meeting in the near future. And the first topic is we wanted to provide an overview of the process that we engaged in to get the proposed rule package to the state that it's in today. Secondly, we wanted to talk to you about how this proposed rule package is better for fish. What does it actually do, or what are the highlights of what it does to improve fish protection? And then third, we wanted to talk to you about our understanding of the concerns that we've heard over the last few years from various stakeholders, governmental entities, including tribes, other state agencies, counties, cities, and federal governments. So that's our game plan for today. And we're going to take turns up here. I'm going to start with the rule update process. This has been, for this particular rule update, it's approximately 300 pages right now. It's been 20 years since it's been updated, so this was no small undertaking. So after 4 years of working with external entities and four drafts, we are where we are. We started internally to develop the first draft we completed it in 2011. After we completed the first draft, we convened a stakeholder advisory group. There were 18 representatives in that group, and you can see the entities that participated in that advisory group. It was a facilitated discussions. We held approximately six meetings with that advisory group. Very good engagement. It was lively, as you can guess. Good content of information, and the result of those meetings and discussions was the development of the second draft rule package in the following year. Of course, we didn't stop there. We continue to engage with representatives of that advisory group, either one-on-one or multiple groups, continue to refine and, in our opinion, improve the draft rule package. And that resulted in the following year the production of an additional two drafts of the rule. So we've had the CR 102 is the fifth draft of this huge rule package, and a lot of time, effort, discussion, compromises that went into it. In the event we hadn't cast our net broad enough in the creation of the advisory group, we conducted 7 statewide public meetings in an effort to get the word out to those who maybe hadn't read about it on our website or participated directly with us. And in our conservative estimate, we've had over 60 meetings over the past few years with individual and multiple groups. All of this said, I think if you looked, you would find flaws in the process. It's an enormous undertaking. There's always polarity surrounding the HPA permit and the code between regulated community, conservation entities, and our mission to do what we can to protect fish life with this permit. So it's always a delicate balance that we try to strike in trying to understand and meet constituents' needs, but not undermining our bottom line interests, which is fish protection. The rule process then went on from our perspective, to respond to the multiple comments we received to the various versions of the drafts. The fourth draft version had 109 pages of comments. We responded in writing to each of those. We prepared the final fifth draft to be sent to the code revisor's office, and learned it would take them approximately 1 month to turn our version into their code their code format. So we decided to distribute our draft version to all of the entities we'd been working with pre-filing. So we did that on May 29th. And then the CR 102 was actually filed on July 16th and is currently open for comment through the middle of this month. In the meantime, we continue to meet and discuss and try to refine the rules with many entities. And as a result, you'll see in your notebook, section 2, there is an amendment to the CR 102. It's about a 10-page document. And these are changes to the CR 102 that we've agreed to with the various constituents and governmental entities. And if the time comes that you're ready to make a decision on this package, we would be recommending to you that that amendment be adopted with the CR 102. And of course, all the draft rule packages and the associated SEPA documents have been reviewed by our Attorney General's office. And of course, we paid attention to their review and comments in developing the proposed rule package that you have in front of you. So now we move on to the second topic of our overview, how these proposed rules improve fish protection. And I'm going to turn it over to Randy Thurston to talk to you about this. I can highlight that these are not all of the ways that the rules improve fish protection, but they're some of the highlights. And in your notebook, in section 5, there is a table by WAC section that identifies specifically the fish protection improvements that the rule offers. And I will also add that for those who came to the meeting today to provide testimony and general interest in the audience, some of the documents in your notebook are available today, and there's also a piece of paper that has the link that references all of the documents, but they've been on our website for the last month or more. So, okay, Randy.
I'll
so you...
I'm going to present an overview of how the proposed rules protect fish life. I'm going to cover how the project design rules have improved, how the work windows have been amended to reflect the most current science, and some improvements we made to the rules to address water quality. So the proposed rules include design improvements for several types of hydraulic projects, including water crossings, which are bridges, culverts, and fords, overwater structures, which are docks, piers, and floats, and bank protection structures. So the 1994 rules stress construction of structurally sound water crossings and are designed to provide adult salmon passage. The proposed rules emphasize water crossing designs need to provide fish passage for all fish species, not just adult salmon. In addition, the proposed rules emphasize culvert design should not constrain stream processes that protect habitat. The existing two design methods, the no slope and the hydraulic method, are not adequate to protect fish life. The proposed rules have methods like stream simulation that pass all fish species, but they also protect the processes that are important to maintaining stream health. The 1994 rules stress the construction of structurally sound bridges designed to prevent flooding. The proposed rules emphasize bridge designs must avoid impacts to channel functions and movement, and bridges should also provide clearance to pass wood, which is an important component to fish for fish habitat. Overwater structures. The 94 rules emphasize that overwater structures in saltwater areas be designed to avoid and minimize impacts to nearshore habitat used by juvenile salmon during their migration and by forage fish during spawning. The proposed rules for overwater structures in freshwater areas also include design standards to protect shallow water habitat used by salmon, such as locating structures away from beach spawning areas. The sharp light-to-dark contrast caused by overwater structures can cause juvenile salmon to go out and around these structures into deeper water. This puts them at higher risk of predation. The 94 rules emphasize designing structures to reduce the effect of shading on juvenile salmon. The proposed rules have the same design standards for freshwater areas where juvenile salmon also migrate. The 1994 rules for bank protection emphasize limiting the length and the waterward extent of the bank protection. The proposed rules emphasize determining the cause of erosion and the risk to property to assess if bank protection is even needed. The 94 rules emphasize the use of large rock. The proposed rules emphasize alternatives such as soft shore protection that protect the property but also protect the habitat forming processes. That the work windows protect fish during the most vulnerable life history stages, such as times of the year when spawning and egg incubation is occurring or when juveniles are present. There have been several studies in the last 20 years to gain more information about how and when fish use certain habitats. The proposed work windows reflect this science. A new section in the proposed rules protects freshwater spawning and incubation periods for 22 priority fish species. Work times in saltwater are adjusted to protect juvenile salmon migrating, feeding, and rearing in the nearshore. And work times to protect herring spawning beds and rockfish nursery and settlement areas have been added to the proposed rules. The 1994 rules did not approve oil-based treated wood for use in lakes. The proposed rules do not approve the use of oil-based treated wood in any water body, and oil-based treated wood is wood such as creosote. The use of copper-based treated wood is allowed, provided it meets treated wood industry standards for use in water bodies. The proposed rules also have several best management practices to prevent sediment and pollution from entering water bodies during construction of hydraulic projects. The new language is also added to prevent the transport and introduction of aquatic invasive species. Rules are added to reduce the risk of harm to habitat, including improved protection for riparian vegetation, reduced impacts from dredging, reduced impacts from beaver dam removal and modification, improved protection of aquatic vegetation. There are also new rules to better protect fish from harm when streams are dewatered to construct hydraulic projects and from sound waves generated by pile driving that can kill or injure fish. So Lisa is going to talk about some of the concerns from tribes and stakeholders.
Okay. So, of course, hello? Did I blow it out? It's my exuberance to talk about concerns with the rules. These, of course, will not be all the concerns that we've heard, but we're trying to identify the primary concerns, and we've put the sidebars for primary based on there's more than one group that had this concern, or it's a concern that has been fairly constant over the years while we were developing the rules. So based on that as our sideboards, what we wanted to talk to you about today, based on what we've heard over the years, is concerns with the jurisdiction, our authority to regulate hydraulic projects, concerns with the permit streamlining provisions that are in the proposed rules, concerns with project costs that may be incurred as a result of the proposed rules, concerns with mitigation costs, as well as the requirements for mitigation. There's also concerns that have been expressed to us about how staff will implement the rules, and we wanted to talk with you about that. And then lastly, a general concern and some specific concerns with the rulemaking process that I gave you a brief overview of at the start of this presentation. So the concerns that we've heard about jurisdiction is that the proposed rules, the CR 102 and the amendment, would expand our authority for hydraulic projects that would be conducted above the ordinary high water line. So in the view of some of the constituents and regulated community, they view that we're going too far, that we're exceeding our authority by what we've proposed to you in the CR 102. Our response to them is we have a disagreement. We are of the opinion that our authority is not limited to regulating hydraulic projects at or below the ordinary high water line. And we base that opinion on the RCW definition of a hydraulic project that defines those projects to be ones that will use, divert, obstruct, or change the bed and or natural flow of waters of the state. And so we don't see the limitation to the ordinary high water line in that definition, and so we do have a disagreement. If our authority was limited to the ordinary high water line, we would view that as a reduced protection of fish life. We would not be able to regulate projects like dikes and levees and bridges that span an area broader than the ordinary high water line. So that's a concern that's been brought to us. It's not a new concern to this rule update. It's been there for some time, but I wanted you to be aware of that. We've heard concerns with our proposed rule that is in place to streamline the permit processing. One of these rules is reflecting current practices, and another would be a brand new approach to streamlining. And those two streamlined processes are called general permits and model HPAs. And the concern that's been expressed to us is these streamlined approaches to regulating hydraulic projects occurs without site visits by biologists. And so we're not able to assess individual impacts to that site from that project. And the conclusion of the concern is, therefore, we are reducing our protection of fish life. Our response to that is we have been issuing general HPAs for some time, for how many years?
At least
10. For 10 years or so. The general recipients of general permits is Department of Transportation and local governments. The general permits, now not talking about the model for a moment, just the general permits cover approximately 2,000 projects a year. We, as an agency, issue permits for approximately 4,000 projects a year, so this is about half of our workload. But general permits are not general documents. They're very specific. They target, in our opinion, low-risk projects. It's routine maintenance and repair of projects like culverts and bridges. And they're very specific, the provisions in the general permit. But the concern is correct, and we are not out there primarily due to limited staff capacity, conducting compliance monitoring of all of these projects. And so we don't have as close of a check on them. The model HPA has a little bit different flavor of a concern based on our understanding of what we've been told. And that concern is, because they're new, there's an uncertainty as to which projects would be eligible to fall under the category of a model HPA. Our thinking about it is fairly simple at this stage of the game. We're viewing this as a bit of an experiment. We're trying to help those applicants that are interested in designing and building projects that are more fish-friendly to be able to do that. So something like soft armoring instead of hard armoring in shorelines of Puget Sound would fit into this model HPA, and we would help make that process easier if indeed the applicant was interested in investing time and resources into a project that's better for fish.
I think Deputy Director Storr has a comment to make.
Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Lisa, you just gave one example, the armoring example. What are some other examples of model where a model HPA might be used?
Funny you would ask. That's probably the best example. We have, there's such a need for that right now for the hard armoring, particularly in Puget Sound, is impeding the nearshore processes, and that has such a negative impact on fish life, particularly juvenile salmon. And so we are trying to dedicate efforts to try to help that big problem statement. So that's where we would start. We would be open to working with stakeholders to help those who think we can make a successful program out of this as to which type of projects are most eligible. We would be looking at things like the materials used, you know, using green materials rather than not. But we haven't over-invested in the design of exactly what would fit the category. It is an experiment.
Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a distinction in the rules between the east side and the west side?
Generally, no, but there are projects that might happen in one part of the state that don't happen in another. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure.
Well, you don't have a microphone.
Yeah.
You have to yell.
Nobody wants to hear from me.
Notice how we...
So some specific distinctions would be like our timing windows, where we actually mention particular stream miles or water bodies that have a different timing, and that's associated with the different data that we have on the fish presence and the different type of fish species and life history traits. But we don't necessarily have a Lake Chelan dock is different than a Western Washington Lake dock.
Well, there again, I work with a lot of roads, so, and there again, your green projects, I don't know whether you're talking about planting trees or what. You know, there again, on this side of the state where you get all the rain you get, yeah, growing trees is fairly easy. In our part of the world, not so much.
Yes, Commissioner Holtzmiller, the intent is to help the applicant who wants to do something good. So we assume we're going to get some pretty creative ideas to the table, and we'll need to work with that applicant or applicants. So as I said to Deputy Storr, we don't have this ironclad designed. It's an idea, more of an experiment, and we'll see how it works.
There again, on that same thought, because there again, we don't have near the moisture when we get it. It's an event.
Yeah.
More so, and there again, if we're trying to go in and plant trees behind a project, good luck. Yeah, I mean, we end up having to go out and water them to get them to grow, which becomes fairly expensive. Whereas, you know, there again, I can see your point about the rocks, but we can put a rock in and it will stay and help deflect the water against the structure when we do get that event. So, thank you.
Okay, so now Jeff gets to talk to you. The bridge costs, I think there was a... Nope, I don't have anything to transfer. So turning it over to Jeff.
All right, yay, I finally get to play. So bridge costs, I think it's fair to say there were... this is an area, and you'll see in the 10-page amendments where we made some recent adjustments even, where there's always the opportunity for us to write words down, listen to what the folks tell us, and then we write some different words down trying to hit the target in the bullseye. And then they tell us, no, that's not quite in the center. And bridge costs, in my opinion, is one of those areas where we were writing words and people were reading them like we were saying we're going to require full span bridges over floodplains. We kept saying, no, that's not what we mean. And we had a recent breakthrough in a meeting we had with Federal Highways and Washington Department of Transportation. So it really boiled down to drawing pictures and going, oh, that's not what we're talking about. So in this particular case, it kind of merges everything. So, Lisa, if you can fly all of those in for me, that would be great. People were getting to, we were going to require full-span bridges because we had the velocity criteria. Now, what we currently use is a backwater calculation, and I can let Bob Bernard, our environmental engineer, and one of the principal authors of our water crossing structure guidance manual, speak more to the specifics of that. My understanding is velocity criteria actually gives us a better methodology to actually measure if and when impacts might start to occur to fish habitat versus how much water is being held back from a bridge span or road fill. And then when people started seeing, hey, wait a minute, they're also saying we have to avoid where the channel might migrate during the life of the project, people, I could see how folks were getting very quickly to, yeah, you had to stay out of a floodplain. The breakthrough we had is that when we're writing all these concepts and rule language down, what we weren't clear about is the fact that the bridge structure is one piece of the road prism. It wasn't the only place that you had to measure the velocity to go under the bridge. So, in other words, you could have relief structures in your road fill, or you could design your road such that in a 100-year flood, it overtops and reduces the velocity through the area where the bridge crossing or main stem is. And I think for the most part, we've addressed most of these concerns, although it would not surprise me if we hadn't addressed all of them.
Bob will be talking about this more, so you didn't
get
that.
Oh, yeah. So, sorry, so before, I just looked at the slide, sorry. Channel migration zones. What we weren't saying is you had to avoid any intrusion into a channel migration zone. What we were saying is when you're designing your structure, and this is consistent with Federal Highways guidance, take a look at where you think that channel is going to go and try to avoid having the channel run right into your structure during the life of the project. Now, that's not always possible. And so what we're saying here is minimize the opportunity for the channel to come into contact with your structure, and then we're all writing permits and you're all out there during high flow trying to throw rock into the scour so that you don't lose your bridge abutment. So I think that we're good. What we are saying here is, yes, indeed, we will approve with this current rule language intrusions into the channel migration zone. We just want people to kind of show that they've gone through those steps to minimize. And now Bob will talk to you about your favorite diagram.
It's
the only diagram.
So what I'm showing here is a sort of a stylized view of a river channel and an associated floodplain, and then four progressively smaller bridges. So in the first case, on the left-hand side, we have a bridge that spans the entire floodplain and the channel migration zone. And to us, this bridge presents no impacts to habitat. But to our applicants, this means a bridge that is probably prohibitively expensive and long, a bridge that could cost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So we can look then to the second bridge from the left and find that we can constrain the floodplain to a certain point after which we have measurable impacts. And we have a method in the proposed rules and in our guidelines to assess what these measurable impacts are or when you reach them. So we believe that you can intrude into the floodplain and into the channel migration zone and have no measurable impacts to fish habitat. But then we move on to the third one, and we have a bridge now which intrudes or constrains the floodplain enough so that we have measurable impacts. We, for instance, block a side channel, that we interrupt some floodplain processes, that it constrains the river enough so that it allows sediment to drop out upstream and produce a widening of the channel upstream of the bridge. And so then we have measurable impacts, and we can show then that we have these impacts and that the designer then should rethink his approach towards the design of this bridge to avoid or minimize those impacts. And then in the fourth case on the right-hand side, we have a bridge which is so small that now it is having multiple and unacceptable impacts to the channel, that it is so small that it produces, that it allows sedimentation upstream and a widening of the stream that we have to protect both the fill and the adjacent banks, that we have flooding that affects upstream neighbors, that we have a constriction so small that it scours the bed and coarsens the bed. So here we have unacceptable measurable impacts. So progressively smaller bridges that have increasing impacts. We can have smaller bridges, but we have to avoid or minimize the impacts to habitat. And then the next slide, please. Am I missing? We got.
No, I was simply going to say, in this particular case, the three on the left go through the HPA permitting process. That the third one from the left, we're probably having conversations about what types of impacts there are and what types of methods would be acceptable to mitigate those impacts, and then the HPA is issued. The one on the far right, we're probably talking about a denial if we can't work with the applicant to get an appropriate design.
Okay.
Thanks, Jeff.
Could you hold the questions till the end? It's a long presentation, so thanks.
Questions or?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to see what the effect of these proposed rules would be on bridges that are built now so that we could see how far are we in our design of bridges now from what we're proposing in these rules. So I looked at 8 bridges, which happen to be federally funded, all built by counties on county roads. And I found that 7 of these 8 bridges would be permitted under the proposed rules. I found one that would not, although this bridge was the subject of a denial and an appeal of a permit, and we ended up with a negotiated design in the end, which, you know, so in other words, we have a negotiated solution rather than one that was chosen through good design. And I think what this emphasizes is that what we're asking for in the proposed rules is just simply good design, and that these are similar to what's asked for in federal guidance on the design of bridges and our other design guidelines by other agencies. So we're not asking for something that is exceptionally larger or more costly than what is normally part of good design.
So I'll try to speed this up. I think it's really important that the people that came here today need to talk with you about all of this. So culvert costs, there were 2 that kind of stood out. We had an alternative design that we proposed. I think the concern that we heard from folks was we don't know it's not predictable. So we don't know what it's going to take in order to propose something other than a no slope or a stream simulation culvert. So the way we're trying to address that and allow for alternative designs is to develop some procedures internally, and clearly we'll have to share that with the folks that are doing these projects so that there's some predictability and transparency. We also built in there some monitoring requirements and some adaptive management. So in other words, if a landowner uses in a similar situation an alternative design and it clearly shows that it can work, they don't always have to continue monitoring. It's a design that we can accept for a longer term approach. This second concern, stream simulation and full span bridges, I believe comes from the federal court injunction against the state as the 2 standards that the state has held to in RISE 1 through 23. However, we do believe that alternative designs can actually work in certain circumstances and still achieve the fish protection that we're looking for.
Sorry.
So the proposed rules establish a baseline for assessing new impacts as the condition of the habitat at the time an applicant applies for an HPA. Most maintenance and repair projects will not trigger compensatory mitigation. However, rehabilitated or replaced projects do have to meet the proposed design standards. If they couldn't meet those standards, then that would trigger compensatory mitigation. There's also a concern of the cost of sediment and large woody material removal, and because it could trigger compensatory mitigation from our stakeholders. The removal of sediment and wood from streams to protect a structure is a common activity, and it can trigger compensatory mitigation because it's a new impact. It wasn't associated with the construction of the original structure, so it's kind of above and beyond that baseline. The HPA is a short-term construction permit, and one of the concerns that we hear is it doesn't provide adequate mitigation or achieve no net loss because we don't require compensatory mitigation for cumulative impacts. And because this is a construction permit, we review these projects on a project-by-project basis and condition the HPAs to achieve no net loss of habitat. In theory, that we are we should be meeting the goal of no net loss or minimizing no net loss from cumulative impacts by doing that, but we don't require applicants to actually mitigate for cumulative impacts. So, for example, if you're dock number 24 on a lake, you wouldn't be asked to do any more mitigation than the person who built the first dock on that lake. So, okay. Some would like the baseline for assessing impacts from work on the existing structures to be the site conditions before the structure existed. This is not the baseline we're recommending. As I said, we're recommending that the baseline be the habitat conditions at the time the HPA application is submitted.
I'm back. again, trying to be quicker here. There's no doubt a critique of the HPA program has always been its inconsistent application on the ground, and we know about that. Certainly, new rules invite inconsistency, so we are all over this one, and we'll be developing procedures on that will provide our biologists the expectations and the outcomes we're hoping to achieve with the new rules. And like any new rule, you have to do pretty substantial training. And when I say training, we'll have significant training internally. But we've talked a lot with others about having cross training. So where we might be training our habitat biologists, we might also be sitting in the room with County Public Works employees, DOT, and other entities, so that we're all hearing and having conversations about the expectations of the implementation of the rules. So concerns about the process, and this is why I've been trying to speed up a little bit on this and let the folks behind us talk. There's no doubt that this is a pretty substantial update. The document is huge. The time frame that we've gone through has been very, very long. Our communication hasn't always been spectacular. We know that this isn't perfect. We know that it will improve fish protection. And we know that if and when we come back in front of you, and it's probably more when, we'll have lessons learned, we'll do a much better process. And what I do know is these folks behind me and the folks that didn't show up that are impacted by the HPA program or benefit from it, need to be involved in the implementation of this thing and how we move forward in the future.
Last slide. So as you commissioners think through considerations for rule adoption, just a few points to leave you with. As Jeff just said, large rule package, but there is significant fish protection improvements in the package. There were a few years before we started working externally, so it's been a 6-year-plus effort to get to where we are today. And it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect. We think it's a good balance of regulatory needs, fish protection needs, but we do want to continue to improve it. We don't have to wait 20 years to come back to you. We don't have to update 300 pages to come back to you. So as we, if you do decide to update these rules, we are committed, Jeff is committed, to work with regulated community and tribes and other governmental entities to make this rule work. And it's going to be a lot of work, and we're committed to doing that. And if in the implementation of the rule we learn that there's a better way to do it, Jeff will come back and propose that to you, hopefully not alone. So that is our briefing, and we turn it over to you.
Okay. Thank you. Excellent. Commissioner Holtzmiller, do you want to ask a question?
Or three? I really don't know how to even structure this one, but do you go back and revisit? Because we ended up getting stuck putting two multiplates in, and that was a new and improved way. And there again, it was in a channel where there's no stream flow except for when we have an event. And honest to Pete, I'm thoroughly certain that we are going to have to go back in and dig the whole fill up and redo it, because it's just turned into a nightmare for us. There again, it isn't a normal stream, it's just an event, and it's undermined the footings. And it's a maintenance nightmare for us, because it's about two-thirds full, because the river happened to be high and it just piled in there. And then once it blew out the next time, it started taking the footings out. So I guess my question is, do you go back and revisit these if they are successes or failures, or where they're successes and where they're failures?
Yes. So the return visits, the number of return visits or site visits that a biologist may perform varies across the state, and that's more often than not dependent on the workload that they have. But that said, so we have the biologists that oftentimes, especially with water crossing structures, because of their potential impact to fish, we go back and we do some post-construction review. Did it turn out the way we thought it would? And then there's another effort going on right now with our Habitat Science Division, taking a look at the implementation effectiveness of the permit itself. So we have multiple looks at it. You'll have a biologist that goes and says, yeah, that's what we agreed to. It looks good. There may be subsequent, you know, drive-by inspections through time. And then you have enforcement at times. We'll do their compliance inspections for enforcement purposes. And then we have our science division with scientific technicians reviewing a subsample of these structures, collecting data to see just how the rules are working.
Yeah, this one was one of those that the design did not fit the application any shape, matter, or form, because there's no water in it. It is not a fish-bearing stream. It's just an event deal, and no, I'm certain we're going to end up having to dig out a major fill and replace it to repair it. Now, the other one, I didn't quite understand you when you said there was wood stacked up against a bridge. What's the process to... Well, there again, we get events, and then we'll get a whole bunch of trees to pile up under a bridge. The water goes down. The right thing to do is to go in and just pull some wood out, some trees, so that we get a flow again, so we hopefully don't lose the structure.
Mm-hmm. Even with wood over into the channel downstream.
Yeah. So in that case, where you're just relocating the wood downstream of the abutment or where it was hanging up, there wouldn't be any compensatory mitigation required for that. If for some reason you needed to go in and remove that wood totally from the system, or you cut that wood into such small pieces that it no longer provided the same kind of function and value for the stream, then that potentially could require compensatory mitigation. But most of the time, people just relocate that wood downstream in.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Michaela.
Thanks. So like on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you expect the new rules to impact the wildlife? than fish. 10 being the best.
Yeah. 10.
She asks tough questions.
9. It's between Bob's 10 and my 8. Yeah. But you can come out and help us monitor, and then we can assess quantitatively.
I think it is one of the great criticisms of our whole approach to salmon recovery. I mean, I've heard it as long as I've been involved that we don't apply as much effort to monitoring effectiveness of these applications, and they do cost a lot of money. And I'm talking about your standard restoration practices, and large woody debris emplacements and stream bank stabilization and culvert replacement. I think we all have good confidence that they are helping, but we don't go out and monitor the effectiveness much. And it's just one of those things that we don't want to pay for. We meaning the public, we meaning the legislature. So it's a good criticism. It's understandable. Okay.
If I may, Madam Chair, just take that the opportunity to respond to that. We chose to realign our existing resources to build an effectiveness and monitoring compliance program of the HPA. It comes at a cost. We have to let go of other things, but it's critical. Agreed.
Yeah. We want to be effective with taxpayer dollars. We've heard loud and clear from taxpayers that they don't want government wasting their money. So it's just something we need to be paying attention to and figuring out if what we've spent money on before is worth spending money on in the future is important. So that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Looks like there's no additional questions. We can move on to the big show, which is hearing from the public.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and Lisa, I have to say this is your last performance, so I mean, we can't even begin to tell you how much you've helped us, educated me personally, Commissioner Mencken, Commissioner Schmidt, everyone. You've just been outstanding. And you in fact, gave me my first briefing as a commissioner in 2005 when I knew nothing about crab in Puget Sound. So thank you for your service. Okay, we have, Tammy's going out to get this testimony sign-up sheets. Okay. This is where we get to hear from you, and we, in the Habitat Committee of the Commission, have heard the briefing that we just received last month. And this has been new for the commissioners who are not on the Habitat Committee. But we all recognize that we'll have more opportunities to think through before we make our decision at the next commission meeting. Oh, no, not in September. Is it going to be in September?
That's an option.
Okay. Well, what I was getting around to saying is that the most important part of today is hearing from you. This is a public hearing, so we see this as the most important part. And we do have, looks like 25 people who've signed up. So I will call you up two at a time. And we would like you to confine your comments to 3 minutes. That's the rule, the commission rule. When you hear the beeping noise, That means your time is up, and we'd like you to conclude. If you're mid-sentence, you can finish your sentence, but don't test the limit too much, because I'll have to jump in and cut you off. I don't like doing that. Okay, William Thomas and Bruce Beatty, please come forward. Okay, Mr. Thomas, you're first.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Bill Thomas, Mount Vernon, Washington, Mineral Prospecting Community. Once again, I'm here to say that WDFW has not done anything to communicate with the mineral prospecting community, and as such, we're here in opposition, at least specifically those rules that they have drafted for the mineral prospecting community on beach mining, and they changed two of the timing windows. They've created a whole new edition of freshwater timing, which are not the same as what they have posed to us, and saying that the science is new and better and everything, and they haven't even discussed whether or not they should change our windows. You look inside the cost-benefit analysis, and they explain that they did not do any communications with us. And as such, they didn't address any of our concerns. They said they engaged us by public comments and through the public hearing process, and they didn't incorporate any changes to any of our comments. Same with the comments that you guys had. They were confusing. There's that ghost shrimp line still in there, still drawing controversy, and that hasn't been removed or resolved. Which brings up the question is why the need of having an additional imaginary line in the sand anyway, when the seashore conservation area is defined as the ordinary high water line all the way down to the low water line. We've been operating in that area for the last 5 years, 2 years of a pilot study, and 3 years of actual HPAs being issued. And there seems to be no detriment, no significant disturbance to fish life. Why now do we need another imaginary line drawn in the sand? Site visits. I noticed that Ms. Fenerosa stated that there was insufficient staff to do site visits. This is one of the things that the department had conceded to the mineral prospecting, that there would be site surveys, there would be 1 year, 5 year permits issued, and yet we have a biologist on the other side of the hill who seems that every single mineral prospecting HPA requires a site visit, and to date she's already done 5 visits to the same piece of creek for 5 different people. So on one hand, it's okay not to do site surveys, I guess. On the other side, we need to do them each and every time. Some of the rules, in our opinion, they violate statute. Your statute says that small-scale mineral prospecting and mining shall not require a permit. And those activities are defined basically as non-motorized equipment. And yet, the rules say that we must have the permit on the job site when working on the ocean beaches. Furthermore, they even have a beautiful picture where the permit's required, where the permit's not required. And that would also be at your imaginary ghost shrimp line also. One of the concerns is the big difference between the monetary amount, $290,000, and $3.6 million per year to implement these rules. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Amy Carey, would you come forward? Is Amy? Did you not want to attempt?
I did, but I thought there was a second.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't know what the problem was. Yes. Okay. We've got it. Okay, Mr. Beatty.
My name is Bruce Beatty from University Place. I had a senior moment the last time I met you, and I said I wasn't going to talk to you again, but I realized we haven't discussed the scope of our small-scale mineral prospecting activity. Today's small-scale mineral prospecting compared to yesteryear is a mere drop in the bucket. Tens of thousands used to prospect and mine in Washington State. Now it is a mere 2,000-plus individuals, about 15% of those miners have dredges. My particular mining partners and I, we take our dredges out of state, so we don't even work here. These two volumes are just two of seven that a group of miners have produced that show the entire history of the mining in the Washington state. This particular volume is from the Department of Conservation and Development, 1955. There's literally hundreds and thousands of locatable minerals that were worked on in this state. There is no empirical evidence from then, as well as from 1970 to present, to show any harm to the streams or fish life from small-scale mineral prospecting. There are 70,000 miles of streams in this state. There are 338 claims in the state today. These are gold claims. If each claim had 100 feet dredged, more than likely it's about 50% of each stream, 50% of the 100 feet. The suction dredge community impacts about 0.009% of 1% of those 70,000 miles. Commissioners Gutzweiler, Perry, and Dr. Chu attended 2 to 3 rallies up on the Similkameen River. Commissioner Perry observed the dredge demonstration and said, "I have been lied to for 30 years. I was told we did dredging of 10 feet wide and 100 feet in one day. It's quite obvious we don't do that. It takes me 2 days to do an area this size with my 4-inch suction dredge. Our drop in the bucket impact coupled with the science, subject matter science, presented along with a recent SEIS from the California Department of Fish and Game, indicates to me that the mining community is well over-regulated. The work window section in the Golden Fish pamphlet have no empirical evidence requiring reductions in the timings of the pre-1999 Golden Fish pamphlet. In the first instance, for 20 years we operated on those work windows, and you have no empirical data to suggest that we needed to decrease those work windows. The miners were okay with the original work windows. I had a chance to work on a claim, no salmon, no steelhead. I got 15 days work window. That's not economically feasible. Thank you.
Thank you. Kyle Loring, would you come forward, please? Okay, Ms. Carey.
Good afternoon. I work as the executive director of Sound Action. We're an environmental group, and we work specifically on nearshore marine protection. I want to thank, first and foremost, the commission. I know this is a long day for you guys. And thanking the department, because I know it's been a long several years. So I appreciate the work that everybody's been doing on these proposed rules. Sound Action, we actually underwent some name changes and some different organizational restructuring, but for the better part of 15 years, we've been doing our work primarily as through direct regulatory oversight, and we're really fortunate we have this great knowledge base in our board of directors and our advisory council, which includes ecologists, GIS mapping specialists, and we actually even have some members who are former DFW Habitat Program staff. So it's great information that we get that way. In 2013, last year, we started some project work where we actually monitor we monitor the application of the hydraulic code as it's occurring through the HPA program. And so we actually read and review each and every marine Puget Sound HPA and all the supporting documentation. And I think that gives us at least a little bit of a unique insight into some of the areas where the program does work and where it doesn't, and pathways that clearly need some improvement. Now, clearly you guys are all aware that the code is the state's primary law designed to protect fish life. Unfortunately, as we all know, too, Puget Sound is in a critically imperiled state. And so it's incredibly important that now more than ever that the department and the commission ensure that the core mission of the code, again, that fish and habitat protection, is met through any of the rule updates. We greatly, greatly appreciate the work the department's done in updating this code, and we actually generally support the idea of updating the code. At the present moment, though we don't fully support the current language, the passage with some of the current language there. There's clearly some areas of improved fish protection that we are thrilled to be seeing, but there's still a range of some new actions and some language that gives us concern that it would result in a lack of oversight for the department and then in turn some lack of fish protection. We've provided the department with some of the preliminary comment on that, and it ranges, they certainly had some of them up there, ranges from the introduction of the model and general permit, some continued gaps in forage fish spawning protection and technical provisions. And I think most significantly our concern is the continued pathway that's established in the rules that allows significant habitat impact with the assumption that mitigation is a solution for that. And what we can see is certainly in the state of the Puget Sound ecosystem is that that's not a successful approach. So we look forward to continued communications with the department and hopefully some resolution to move forward. I want to thank you guys again for your work, and hopefully we'll move this forward.
Thank you. Okay, let me call up Paul Randall Gruder. Okay, Mr. Loring.
Thank you. My name is Kyle Loring. I'm the staff attorney for a conservation organization in Friday Harbor called Friends of the San Juans. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment today. And I'm providing a perspective as somebody who experiences or practices in both the Shoreline Master Program arena and through the hydraulic project approval arena as well, a little bit of each. And I think I can bring a perspective where I've seen the hydraulic code undermine some of the efforts the local communities have tried to make under their shoreline master programs to protect some of the shorelines. And we focus quite a bit on marine shorelines, development along those shorelines like bulkheads, docks, marinas, a lot of those. And so we envision an opportunity through these rules and these rule updates to bolster the efforts of the Shoreline Master Program in the same way that the Department of Fish and Wildlife does on biological resources, through a lot of that research. And Friends has had the opportunity to do that with the Department of Fish and Wildlife as well. So what are some of the – well, the first thing I'd like to comment on is that 30-day comment period is too short. And we heard that 30 more days wouldn't be enough. I know that this has been a long process. Friends has been involved to some of the starts and stops off and on as well. But some of the more recent changes have been significant, and a 30-day window for commenting on such a significant change to the state rules is too short. And so we request at least a 60-day window there. In addition, with some of the specific language, one of the changes that is an interesting one is the change to the definition of the protection of fish life. Instead of the current language, which speaks to the prevention of loss or injury, now the language would be the avoiding and minimizing of impacts to fish life. And that avoidance or minimization, sometimes avoidance and minimization, works its way through those rules. And as soon as you start combining those two words, it sounds like you've got a choice. And that's what we see up in the San Juans. We see somebody choosing minimization, or at least an attempt at minimization. So we recommend the retention of the current protection of fish life definition, because it sets the tone that really is the goal, to protect the fish life, not to allow for some impacts and then hope to compensate for those later on, especially when the science shows that compensatory mitigation is often unsuccessful at replacing the functions lost. We also recommend, against the staff recommendation for a no net loss definition that would include that avoid or minimization language. Again, we think to the extent that the mitigation sequence should apply, it should start at avoidance and place a heavy emphasis on that and then work its way down as necessary there. But we do appreciate several proposed changes, and I want to touch on those very briefly. One, the staff recommendation to include language that staff may deny bank permits, because that is important. Just announcing that and saying that could happen in some instances would be important. In San Juan County, to my understanding, no projects have been denied. And lastly, we appreciate the recommendation to construct all bulkheads or other bank protection, and that they must result in no permanent loss of surf smelt spawning habitat. That's important, and thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Okay, Sarah Grice. Okay, Mr. Randall Gruder.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, good afternoon. I'm Paul Randall Gruder. I'm the County Engineer of Skagit County. There are several other counties here today who'd like to testify, and I'd just like to start off. Counties agree with the WDFW stated goals of the rulemaking process of improving and clarifying the WAC rules for issuing HPA permits. We interpret these goals to be predictability, streamlined, clear permitting process, consistency, protect fish life, and to apply best available science. We believe that the goals stated in the rulemaking process and documents would be associated with developing the WAC rule to be consistent with the current statute for governing a hydraulic project permit process. I'd like to list some, but not all, of county concerns in no particular order. First off would be the consistency with RCW. We believe that the department is constrained by its statutory authority, it's RCW 7755, and cannot expand its jurisdiction without legislative amendment. The department's use of guidance documents to condition permits as opposed to guiding implementation of the WACs is inappropriate. Another concern is expanded authority. Usage of the word near with waters of the state, this term would move the authority of the HPA permit landward of the OHWL. Usage of the phrases of words related to permitted activities in floodplain. We feel this phrase would also move the authority of the HPA landward of the ordinary high water level. Reach analysis and references to other studies as determined by the department. These terms and applications would expand the authority of the HPA permit beyond those related to RCW 7755-231. The final concern we'd like to address is the reestablishment of the ordinary high water level. The OHWL reestablished landward of the shorelines after a bank protection structure was built and reestablished. Storm or flood damage of those or other types of catastrophic failure of a permitted structure doesn't equate to abandonment and the original permit process requires and therefore allows the maintenance and repair of the structure. I'm joined, like I said, with other counties here, and they'd like to express some other concerns as well.
Thank you. Scott Lindblom. Okay, Ms. Grice.
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'm Sarah Grice of Mason County, and I will be speaking in regards to the WAC revision process. It has been difficult to follow the revisions and latest versions of the WAC throughout the process. Several counties met with WDFW in late May of this year to discuss the most recent version of the proposed WAC. I believe that there have been two revisions since then, the most recent revision posted just this week. This makes it very difficult to provide meaningful and timely review and comment. We hear from WDFW staff that we should support the WAC revisions as proposed, and then, once they are completed, work together to establish agreements to clarify the implementation. This feels backwards. It seems to me that there's very little incentive, energy, or budget to come back to the table once the WAC is adopted, thus leaving WDFW to interpret the WAC in any way that they see fit. This is a real concern to me and to other counties and could have far-reaching impacts to our programs, our budgets, and the services that we provide. It would be prudent to look more closely at how these changes will affect local agencies and our users. WAC revisions should stand on their own and not require a memorandum of understanding to help us interpret state law. Therefore, we have the following four requests. Extending the comment period for the WAC revisions in SEPA. Developing WAC language that stands on its own without the need for agreements. Phasing sections of the WAC and or piloting areas that continue to be of concern, especially since we just heard from the presentation that these are ideas and experiments. And lastly, provide adequate funding for WDFW staff and conduct workshops and training for both staff and stakeholders to ensure a common understanding of new WAC revisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Paula Cox. Okay, Mr. Lindblom.
All right, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Scott Lindblom. I'm the Acting County Engineer for Thurston County. Thurston County has a very good relationship working with WDFW engineers, planners, and biologists, and we want that to continue. Like DFW, Thurston County wants to ensure the protection of fish life and fish habitat. We all need to be good stewards of both our environment and of our critical infrastructure. We strongly support improving and clarifying the WAC rules for issuing HPAs, which include the following goals: protection of fish life, streamlined programs, clear permitting process, timely review of applications, consistency, and applying best available science to maintenance and design projects. But we have great concerns about the proposed rules as drafted. Because my time is limited, I'm here only to focus on the maintenance definitions. However, I strongly support the comments offered by the Regional Road Maintenance Forum. The proposed changes split the different elements of maintenance into separate definitions. For example, repairing, maintaining, remodeling, preserving, altering, restoring, and replacement. This is not consistent with maintenance described in WAC 197-11-800-3, the Regional Road Maintenance Guidelines approved by NOAA, CFR 1508.20, and the Western Washington Stormwater Manual. The proposed WAC changes the definition of maintenance to making minor alterations to a facility. The proposed definition of rehabilitation would dramatically lower the threshold when a structure would need to be totally replaced to meet current standards. The proposed definition of replacement would also dramatically lower the threshold when a structure would need to be totally replaced to meet current standards. These definition changes will require existing structures to be replaced long before the end of their intended design life. This represents a significant cost increase and is not a prudent use of very limited taxpayer money. These premature costs would otherwise not be associated with maintenance. We request that these issues be resolved before these rules are adopted. Thank you.
Thank you. Samuel Castro. Are you Samuel Castro? No? Oh. Okay, Ms. Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. I am Paula Cox. I'm Assistant County Engineer with Chelan County. Chelan County supports Thurston County's discussions, and I'd like to provide a general example of the impacts from the proposed rules that we see. First, I'd like to say Chelan County has the same focus as Department of Fish and Wildlife with our guidance on the environment and also with the public safety. Many of Chelan County roads are sole or primary access to remote areas of the county. The county also has many permanent water structures, most of which are fish-bearing streams. As you may know, Chelan County has gone through our fair share of fires and flooding lately. And preserving our roadways to maintain continual access for public safety and emergency responders is becoming more and more difficult throughout the years due to financial burdens and also the unpredictability in environmental permitting conditions that have been imposed on our maintenance and preservation projects. The proposed rules will increase unpredictability in the environment, environmental permitting conditions, thereby increasing costs and delays, prohibiting or delaying maintenance and or repairs to our crossing structures, specifically prior to predicted flooding events within burned watersheds. These rules will ultimately potentially cause the county to restrict and close roadways because of the inability for us to financially comply with these proposed requirements. These restrictions and closures will not only impact general public, but also those emergency responders, inhibiting or significantly delaying emergency responses. Corrections to the definitions and additional considerations to the thresholds, as discussed by Thurston County, will assist with these issues, definitely. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Rod Lakey. Mr. Castro.
Madam Chair and Board of Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Sam Castro. I'm the Public Works Director for Pondere County. Pondere County and Federal Highways, WASDOT and local programs, including Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, met to discuss a bridge replacement project recently. The inlet bridge at Sullivan Lake is structurally deficient and requires replacement. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife concerns are that the bridge may be impacting the flow several hundred yards upstream. The flows go subterranean or underground in this area. Based on this, the discussion led to Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife requesting a study to determine if the bridge was impacting the area upstream. The cost of the studies are out of our scope and funding requirement. The study would delay our project. The cost of the study could be in excess of $100,000. FHA informed everyone at the meeting that the funding provided by their source could not be used for this purpose, including any additional cost to increase the length due to the study. This is an example of how these rule changes will impact our projects. These issues need to be resolved prior to any rule changes. The Federal Highway Administration letters to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, SEPA comments, indicated that, in their opinion, the proposed WAC stream crossing section was not based on technically sound engineering practices and not based on significant research. See Federal Highway letters dated November 15, 2013 and April 3, 2012, and WASDOT letter dated March 12, 2014. In addition, these terms and applications would expand the authority of the HPA permit process beyond those related in RCW 77.55.31. States, conditions imposed upon a permit must be reasonably related to the project. The permit conditions must ensure that the project provides proper protection for fish life, but the department may not impose conditions that attempt to optimize conditions for fish life that are out of the proportion to the impact of the proposed project. Thank you.
Brian Stacy. Hey, Mr. Lakey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I'm Rod Lakey with Lewis County Public Works. And specifically, I have a point regarding the revised August 5th staff recommendations for amendment to the hydraulic code. Section 194D in that, and this is Mr. Davis eloquently put it that this was a much to-do subject with the bridges, but still in the language, the department will has been struck out and replaced with may approve encroachment into the expected pathway of lateral migration if it can be shown to avoid or minimize impacts to fish life, and it goes on. Lewis County has been proactive, and actually we've completed a channel migration zone study in some of our streams and rivers, and we classify low, medium, and high channel migration zone. We have 1,100 miles of road and 215 bridges in Lewis County, and many of those cross or are adjacent to these streams. The word may scares us just for the fact that it could be interpreted later after these rules are imposed. It's kind of a belt and suspenders because they're saying it may be approved if it can be shown to not impact fish life. I guess we're requesting that the word be returned to will, because it's basically commenting or making the recommendation there that it will be approved if you can show no adverse impact. And just to give an example, this migration zone, the picture that they had shown up there did show the floodplain. And this is talking about lateral migration. I see a difference myself, just because the migration could extend beyond the flood zone, floodplain, and in our instance, we have an example of we just completed the bridge, or just actually bid a bridge that was $6 million for construction. By the time we get to permitting, our cost for design, preliminary engineering, environmental, just to get to that point to submit to HPA. We would be in the $400,000-$500,000 range on that $6 million bridge to find out that it may be approved. So we definitely agree with the sound engineering principles and practices that was presented earlier by the wildlife staff. However, just clarifying that word or making it, since it is a permanent code change or a rule change, we recommend that will be approved, brought back into it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Melissa McFadden. Mr. Stacy.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thank you for the time. My name is Brian Stacy. I'm the Pierce County Engineer. I'm going to share with you a recent project story or an example that has been a little bit of a challenge for us as well. The details in the story are important, I suspect, but the take-home message for me is that without definitive code language, the interpretations in the field many times appear to be arbitrary and capricious for those of us trying to get these projects done. My county was operating under an HPA to construct a pedestrian bridge over a creek. All of the in-water work was done prior to the close of the in-water work window, which happened to be September 15th in that instance. At that point in time, DFW required us to get an extension of the HPA work window to allow for construction of the remainder of the bridge over the water. Again, all of the water in, or all the work in the water itself or the ordinary high water was done. We were actually outside on dry land finishing the work on the abutments of the bridge themselves. The concern, as it was shared with us, is we had a swing rig up in the high area that we were bringing. It was operating like a cherry picker, and we were taking equipment over to the bridge itself. And the concern that was expressed to us was that that piece of equipment would potentially cast shadows and spook the fish, and therefore required mitigation for the impact. They suggested to us the mitigation would be for us to remove an old concrete footing that once supported an old railroad bridge, not related to this project. As with many of these projects, we were right in the middle of this construction. We had a lot invested, obviously, and we had a contractor that was potentially going to charge us for delays if we wrestled too long with the DFW folks. And so we chose to just mitigate. We just said we'd do it. What is it that you want us to do? As it turns out, actually, the mitigation ended up being they changed their mind, and we ended up adding a large woody debris to fully mitigate our impact of the shadows across the creek itself. Again, all of these requirements that came as a result of the HPA time extension were unanticipated, never discussed prior to that time. It's very difficult, as you can imagine, to manage scope, schedule, and budget for a project when the ground rules change in the middle of your project. So the point here is that the HPA permitting process, all of us want to do the right thing. All of us want to protect the resources. It just needs to be predictable. If it's going to be a moving target, then the taxpayers, in my particular case of Pierce County, are experiencing delays in projects, more costly fish-related projects, which then affects the other bottom line for us. It's the MOPI equation. We've got maintenance, operations, preservation, improvement, and administration. Those all cost dollars to do as well. If we're spending money, and what I would say is not necessarily bringing value to the resources, it's pulling it away from the other limited resources that I have. And I just think collectively we can use those resources more wisely, still protect the environment, the fish, the resources, all those types of things, and accomplish where we need to go. But we've got to work together to do that. And Mr. Davis has spent a lot of time with our group and has been very, very helpful. We just haven't got to the folks that are out in the field yet. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Loretta Swanson. And Ms. McFadden.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Melissa McFadden. I'm the Mason County Engineer. What I would like to talk about today is the fact that the supporting data that's been presented to us by WDF staff does not convince us that there's been adequate external peer review or that there's a good return on investment with these WAC revisions. I plan to offer an example as well. WDFW staff at this hearing, in fact, presented a study indicating that 7 out of 8 county bridges replaced since 2006 actually already meet the provisions of the proposed new WAC. That's about an 87% average. This might be used to draw the conclusion that there would not be significant economic implications with implementation of these rules. That got me thinking, so I consulted the Washington State Bridge Database for local agency bridges and found that 258 bridges have been constructed by counties alone during that same time period. I wonder personally if the 87% compliance rate holds true for all 258 bridges, or if it would be closer to 7 out of 258, or somewhere in between. At any rate, showing that 7 out of 8 new bridges already meet the new WAC provisions, and therefore the financial impacts to local agencies and our users is minimal, is not a fair assessment. I would also like to tell you about the 8th bridge, the bridge that didn't meet the requirement. The Tohoo River Bridge is in Mason County. It washed out during our 2007 flood event, which I understand can be considered a 250-year event. As you know, that means we have a 0.4% chance of repeating that event in any given year. The HPA was originally rejected because WDFW indicated that the county must replace the 88-foot structure with a 116-foot long structure based on backwater analysis, the issue that the WDFW staff was just talking about. This would have allowed for passage of a 500-year flood event and increased our project cost by $375,000. The county appealed and was ultimately granted an HPA for the structure as designed because WDFW was unable to demonstrate that detrimental impacts to fish life would occur as a result of the design, which is the only grounds for denial of an HPA under state law, RCW 7755021. Unfortunately, that discussion took hours of county and WDF staff time and negatively impacted our citizens due to the associated delay. Now I see that backwater analysis is an integral part of the proposed rules, and that's disappointing. The Tahuya River Bridge, I might add, received an award for Best County Project in 2011 from the Federal Highway Administration. I can't take any credit for the work. I didn't work at Mason County at the time, but I can say that there have not been any fish issues with fish passage since its construction. This is just one example of the open interpretation of the WAC that we would hope to avoid through rulemaking. But this version does not resolve that, in my opinion. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Gary Rowe. Okay, Ms. Swanson.
Good afternoon, Commissioners, Madam Chair. Loretta Swanson, also with Mason County Public Works. Thank you for your endurance this afternoon. I will hit on one of the primary concerns that was addressed in your staff report and a common theme that you've already heard as well, and that is the concern of cost. I'd like to first talk to you very quickly about the three ways that counties are not only good stewards of the environment and transportation system, but also good stewards of our local, state, and federal funds. And I'd also like to highlight the three ways that we actually carry out and deliver habitat and fish passage improvement projects. The first you've heard a bit about, and that is when we need to provide routine maintenance or replacement of our culverts under our transportation system. Often we provide habitat and fish passage improvements at the same time. The second area is when we have to make capital improvements to our infrastructure. So we're widening, we're making large improvements. At that time, we have large capital improvements associated with fish passage, and habitat improvements as well. And the third way that counties deliver improvements to habitat and fish passage is above and beyond normal transportation responsibilities. Many of us set aside special funds and collaborate with tribes, resource groups, and others to just do standalone projects. And our fear with the proposed revisions is that we will lose that diversity in delivering projects, and that the proposed revisions will eliminate a lot of our routine diverse maintenance activities that are spanning a lot of geographies, and will end up basically delivering large, single, smaller smaller location projects. And so the question I think we have to ask is that the intent? And if so, great. And if it is not, I think an urge that we look a little more closer at how the WAC is written and continue to work on revising so that we're able to deliver a variety of projects. I thank you for your time this afternoon and encourage you to perhaps set the comment period a little bit further and give us a little more time to work out some of these details with staff. And thanks, staff, for the time that they've put to it so far.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Terwilliger.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Gary Rowe. I'm the Managing Director of the Association of County Engineers, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Counties representing all 39 counties. Counties maintain own and maintain 40,000 miles of road throughout the state. Those roads have been developed over a long period of time from statehood until to the present, and many of those roads, while they may not be have been built to a particular standard at the beginning, most of those roads were built to the standards of the day. They were built with appropriate size culverts and with permitted structures at the time. But as you know, over time, and with the current standards, many of those structures do not meet fish passage barrier requirements and are targeted for fish passage barrier removal or replacement. This is a very significant issue for counties. DFW right now estimates that we have about 3,000 culverts in western Washington that do not meet the requirements and are considered fish barriers. And those 3,000 barriers do not have funding for replacement. You've probably heard that that the Department of Transportation is having to replace under court order in the neighborhood of 800 to 1,000 barriers with a price tag in excess of $2 billion. We don't know what the price tag would be for county government. We know that it would be significant, and we know we don't have the resources to do it. In the meantime, the infrastructure continues to need to be maintained and continues to age. We believe that the rules that are currently proposed do not provide enough flexibility to be able to allow counties to be able to maintain their infrastructure in a reasonable way while they're waiting for and finding those resources to do the replacement or repair in a fashion that meets the requirements. We believe the rules need to provide more flexibility, as was described by one of our previous county engineers. I also want to talk about the process for obtaining permits. You've also heard that counties have to go through a significant process to be able to get permits. You may hear at times that the state meets a large amount of their permits required to be done within the 45-day requirement by state law. But that doesn't count the time that it takes for counties to meet with and negotiate and try to obtain conditions on permits that would be acceptable to be able to get the projects done. That time period could be in excess of a year or more, and many times adds to the cost of the project because of the delay and that type of thing. So we believe that the rules should be improved to be able to make sure that there's adequate allowance for the upfront time to be able to develop permits, and obviously to be able to get those in a position where we know what to expect when we're getting a permit. We also have to have consistency in applied, so we don't have to guess at what we're going to be looking at for projects in the future. DFW staff has been great to work with in terms of providing us opportunity for input. They've expressed a desire to work out these issues. We believe those issues should be worked out before adoption of the rules, not after adoption. There's no ability to try to solve those problems after the rules are adopted. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Geiger.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the Senior Forester for the Washington Forest Protection Association. We are a trade association with small and large landowners, forest landowners, that own about 4 million acres here in the state of Washington. We believe in sustainable forestry, and we were a principal in the landmark Forest and Fish Law in 1999. And because of that law, we have spent over $200 million upgrading roads and culverts in the state of Washington. In fact, Washington State Department of Natural Resources and industrial landowners together have put together plans to fix over 5,200 culverts in the state and open up over 3,200 stream miles. So it's safe to say that we are serious about salmon recovery, and we know a lot about culverts. We'd also like to thank the staff on this, Jeff, Terry Jackson, Randy Thurston, Bob Bernard, Don Nauer, and Lisa Veneroso have been terrific to work with, and we really appreciate that. For version 3 of the draft, we had about 16 pages of very serious concerns. The last letter that I sent in had about 3 pages, and so we've come very far in our understanding of what the rule is in supposed to do and also working through some of the issues. In the forested environment, there is also an additional complication in that the hydraulic code is not implemented in the forest environment by WDFW, but by the Department of Natural Resources. So there's an integration there that we've been working with both departments on. 3 specific rules, and I'll save the rest for my written comments. The first, on the rule itself, you've heard issues related to the jurisdiction, and we also have concerns about that. The use of the word bankful width exceeds the ordinary high water line, that is what the statutory jurisdiction is for the state, and we feel that those provisions should go back to the ordinary high water line. Second, in terms of the rule itself, alternative designs were implemented or put into the rule partly to satisfy the need to have alternatives to full stream simulation designs. There was a recent study that's been done by WDFW in terms of adaptive management, looking at a statistical sample across the state, or actually across Western Washington, of culverts. Of their 48 culverts, only 7 were stream simulation. The others were other types of designs. So it gives you a sense of the importance of those other designs. Second, in terms of the small business economic impact statement, we believe that the baseline should be the current rule, not guidance that WDFW has put out or other types of regulations that are out there. We think that the law is pretty clear that when agencies are adopting new rules, they have to assess the old rule against the new rule, not the new rule against some guidance that might be out there. And then finally, in terms of the environmental impact statement, we are reviewing this. We continue to have concerns about over-reliance on the science related to stream simulation, but we are so happy to work with Department of Fish and Wildlife and the staff to continue to deal with some of these concerns and solve some of the problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Robert Carstensen. Hey, Mr. Geiger.
Okay. Hello, Commissioners. Thank you for your time today. My name is Rich Geiger. I am a district engineer for a group of conservation districts in Puget Sound, but I'd like to make my comments today as a private individual. In developing projects to conserve or restore natural resources, we go to private landowners and we attempt to solicit their cooperation to allow us to go forward with the project on their land. Many times we will run into key considerations from the landowners based on their desired land use and their existing land operations, and that includes many times agriculture and forestry. So what I would ask is that when we are looking for a local landowner to cooperate and implement a project, that is going to benefit the habitat and the species or the population, that the local area habitat biologist be empowered to negotiate in good faith with the project developer and the private landowner to develop projects which will benefit the habitat, that will make sense and make it easy for the landowner to say, yes, it makes sense for me to cooperate, and that this judgment be based on the expected benefit of going forward with the project, even though it may not quite meet the upcoming rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Cindy Aaliyah. Okay, Mr. Carstensen.
Commissioners, my name is Robert Carstensen. I'm from Bremerton, Washington. I happen to be a small businessman, very small. I'm one of the handful of dealers that are still left in the state that is selling small-scale mining equipment. I've been on a couple of the commissions here, or whatever they were. One of the things I have found in my years of observing, I do not have a bunch of alphabetic after my name. All I've got is School of Hard Knocks. And one of the things is I've gone out with the miners and watched and seen what they do. One of the things that they do is they, with the dredging, they used to leave small holes, a couple, 3-4 feet deep. And you know what happens? The fish go in there to get away from the predators. But now, according to regulations, we have to fill those holes in. Number two, we dredge up and cut up the bottom of the gravel. And you know, when I come back in the next year or two, there's more fish there. And they're fatter. And since I have drowned a few worms, I like catching those fatter fish. It's One of the things is we are, the regulations that you're giving us are too restrictive. You're actually violating the 1872 mining laws. Because this is the oldest laws. They're still active on the books. And you're restricting my ability, since I am a third-generation Washingtonian, to go out and mine and to work the beaches, the stuff. So one of the things is that there is no scientific data that says that we have harmed any fish. The ones that I have seen are the fishermen walking along the banks, walking on the reds. And in one of the meetings, we brought that up. They said, oh, that's okay. They have a license, and we don't have a license. We don't need a license. We have the law. But this is one of the things that you're violating. And the work windows and the time, you know, Mother Nature is a female, and she is never the same one year to the next. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Carl Schroeder.
Good afternoon. My name is Cindy Alia, and I live in Issaquah, Washington. Having reviewed the previous, I don't know what you would call it, outlet of documents, and attending the previous hearing and seeing the addition to these documents, including some apparently last-minute information, which I haven't even had a chance to look at, I'd like to recommend to you that for the sake of taxpayers, municipalities, industry, and private property owners, you will extend, I would recommend, a 90-day comment period. I think it's only the right way to react to all the previous comments I've heard, even just in this hearing. So I would thank you to do that.
Thank you. Neil Falkenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Carl Schrader. I'm with the Association of Washington Cities, and we represent the 281 cities in the state of Washington. And I'm going to try not to repeat anything you've heard. We share most of the concerns that you've heard addressed from the counties and some of the concerns that the forest industry brought up. Jurisdiction, you know, is a huge issue. You've probably heard more than you ever want to hear about that. But it does roll itself through this document all the way. So it's been difficult to figure out how to interact with this process when the fundamental question kind of is one that you disagree with. We agree that the statute is clear, that the authority is below the ordinary high water line. Another element of this that's been a little troublesome and not sure how to what to do about this, the white papers that this, the science that this relies on, you have the roll-up in your packet. We have folks who are going back and looking at the specific citations, and there's a great number of them that are marked as working drafts, do not cite. The shoreline modification white paper from 2007, the fish passage white paper from 2008, the overwater structure and non-structural piling white paper from 2006 says that given the uncertainties described above, this risk evaluation is at best a qualitative assessment and based on work experience of the team in the context of endangered species and not HPA. So, you know, we have questions about the whether it's appropriate to utilize scientific resources that are clearly marked do not cite and draft and working paper, et cetera. And then some of those guidance documents that are referenced within this latest rule are referenced in sort of perpetuity. So there's not a rulemaking process to go in and change any of those things. So the rule says you need to follow this guidance document, and then the guidance document can change without a public process. So that's a concern as well. But what I really wanted to spend some time on was the issue of culvert sizing and stream crossing for cities. I don't know if this is obvious, but if you look at the Plum Street Automotive down the road there, there's a little stream that goes into a culvert that then goes about a mile under city roads into East Bay. And we have serious concerns about this rehabilitation and maintenance provisions and the requirement to meet a new culvert sizing standard that might result in a significantly larger culvert in the context of a buried culvert underneath miles of city blocks. and the department staff have been great to work with throughout this process. They, you know, have been asked to do something. They do not have the resources to run the sort of process that I know they would like to, but we have not yet been able to resolve some of these issues, and they're attempting to put in flexibility that is definitely something we'd like to see. But we need to see certainty that that flexibility is something that we can access, because we can't have permits challenged that rely on alternative design methods and alternative ways to deal with this, and then get stuck, you know, in a situation where we need to build that sort of infrastructure. It's just not the best place to spend public resources on fish protection or on infrastructure. So we would concur with the idea of holding off on this rule until those things are resolved, expanding the comment period so people get a chance to really dive into this, and appreciate your time.
Thank you. Rosendo Guerrero? Okay, Mr. Falkenberg.
Madam Chair and Commissioners, my name is Neil Falkenberg. I'm here today representing the Northwest Marine Trade Association. The NMTA is a region-wide organization with 725 members, and our mission is to grow boating. Our sector represents $4 billion of economic activity for the state of Washington. We appreciate the work that WDFW does in protecting fish life, water quality, and important habitats that support fish life. Without clean water and abundant fish, our members lose one of the most important avenues by which they earn their living. Our members need certainty and flexibility in development and implementation of proposed rules and permits. As WDFW works hard to create and refine rules and permits, they affect the important water-dependent economy and all of our member institutions. We feel strongly that certainty is only achieved if the new rules take our members' work into consideration. As stated in my opening, NMTA members and organizations provide important economic, recreational, and conservation opportunities throughout Washington State. NMTA requests involvement in future public processes undertaken by WDFW related to water-dependent businesses, industries, and recreational groups. NMTA requests notification of all remaining components of the rulemaking process so that we might provide timely review and input. Thank you.
Thank you. Ann Van Swearingen. Okay, Mr. Guerrero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Commission, Rosendo Guerrero, Washington Council, Trout Unlimited Chairman. I'd like to thank you for this comment period and allowing me to come forward and express our gratitude, and thank you for inviting us. As the chairman of Trout Unlimited, I represent over 5,000 members in our state alone. Though this changes are not perfect, we know they're needed. Enforcement is definitely a must. I've submitted my comments to you already, so I'll make my comments brief. I know Commissioner Schmidt would like to get back home eventually, see his family. So, you know, Trout Unlimited understands the difficulty position with WDFW, and the commission finds itself when it comes finding a balance between the aquatic activities, and we again thank you for your hard work. While we do still see a need to further strengthen protection for critical fish species, and we feel the importance of enforcement is being overlooked, though it's not perfect, this is a step in the right direction. And the Washington Council on Trout Limited fully supports the changes to our HPA process and look forward to working with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to adoption and implementation of these new changes. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom Davis. Okay. Ms. Van Swearingen.
My name is Ann Van Swearingen. I'm a wildlife biologist with a conservation and wetlands background, and I'm representing the Black Hills chapter of the Audubon Society. Black Hills Audubon is part of Audubon's Pacific Flyway Initiative to protect birds and their habitats. Now, marine birds, particularly birds that dive for their meals, rely exclusively on forage fish, whose populations have dwindled dramatically. As a result, marine birds are also in significant decline. Overwintering populations in the U.S. have decreased by almost 50% since 1980. The hydraulic code and HPA permit is the state's premier law specifically designed to protect fish life and supporting habitats from construction work in the near shore. The code and HPA rules are critical in ensuring the health of Washington's marine, freshwater, and nearshore habitats. The provisions the commission adds to the HPA must protect fish species and habitats. Black Hills Audubon would like to request that a majority of the hydraulic permits that are approved satisfy the following conditions. They meet the standard of no net loss and maintain language that protects habitat and prevents loss to fish and shellfish. They see that the permitting process uses adaptive management to effectively evaluate cumulative impacts. They see that maintain timing restrictions for construction work for all at-risk fish, including forage fish and their spawning activity. Protect eelgrass beds and macroalgal beds where forage fish spawn. Reduce shading impacts from overwater structures. And last but not least, add pre-construction site visits to the permitting process. We appreciate the good work that DFW has done on the rulemaking process, and we urge the Commission to use this rulemaking activity to further strengthen the HPA process. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Hyatt. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. It's good to see you all again on this beautiful Friday. Appreciate the work you do. We also appreciate the work that the Habitat program staff has done on this rule. Doesn't mean we agree with everything, but we certainly appreciate the work and the opportunities for discussion with many of them, recognizing it's a monumental task. A couple areas of concern. As others have said, you've heard some of this already, but jurisdiction, mitigation, and then I want to talk about sand and gravel removal very quickly as well. So with jurisdiction, we know this, and the legislators over the years, this has been one of the greatest areas of contention and probably will be for as long as this regulatory program is in place. We do concur with the comments from the Washington Forest Protection Association regarding ordinary high water line versus bank full width. So we would just concur with their line. We think a brighter line is needed on where jurisdiction resides, and that will make the job of the habitat biologist easier as well, as opposed to if it's unclear, then you're going to have change, differences based on the subjective nature of a human being and a biologist on site, where an HPA is required or not. And that will continue to keep legislators focused on their concern as well as they hear from their constituents. I have some personal experience from that. Mitigation. Enough has been done to provide consistency across the state on what qualifies as required mitigation versus desired mitigation. And this is something that has resided within the program, I think, for as long as it has existed as well. And it is the most expensive part of the program. So the permits are cheap. The mitigation can be very expensive, and so that's, to our members, a very important thing. I don't know if I mentioned I'm representing the Washington Farm Bureau. That's important for the record. And lastly, sand and gravel removal. For our members all across the state, being able to clean out ditches, keeping streams flowing so that they don't overflow into farm fields is something that's important. There's new language added in the WAC that's not in existing WAC, and we think it's biased. It's in 220, 110, 180. It only calls out potential problems with sand and gravel removal when done incorrectly or in the wrong location, but it doesn't mention any positive attributes if it's done properly and in the right location. And we believe that there are times where gravel removal, sand removal can be a positive thing, and it, not only for the fish, but also for the landowner to maintain proper flows through those water bodies, be they man-made or altered. Thank you for the opportunity to see you again today.
Thank you. Susie Calhorn. Okay, Mr. Hyatt.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment this afternoon. My name is Tim Hyatt. I'm a biologist with the Skagit River Systems Cooperative in LeConnor. SRSC represents the Swinomish and the Sauk-Swiatl Indian tribes. I review HPAs every day. Although SRAC and our member tribes are in support of many of the new protections for fish in the updated hydraulic code, we nevertheless have several concerns that we would like to see addressed before the new rules become law. I'm going to hit a few high points, but the details of what I'm saying are in a letter that I submitted earlier today. First and foremost on our minds is the section on general HPAs. We think GHPAs do not offer nearly enough protection or scrutiny, either from WDFW biologists and their or from the tribes. We think it puts far too much discretion in the hands of county road crews to determine what needs to be done. We think that section should be struck until we can arrive at some language that actually addresses the problems. A couple of important definitions in the proposed code need some minor modification that would result in major benefits. One is to give the definition for replacement structures a time limit. This is being proposed for docks and piers, but not for other structures. Often these structures are decrepit or derelict for many years or non-existent, and yet they can be replaced under the replacement section with very much less scrutiny. The definition for the protection of fish life has been changed, and not for the better. It's been watered down in this new version. We simply need to revert to what's currently in the existing WAC to fix that problem. The provisions for large woody debris removal and repositioning, likewise, are slightly less protective than what's in the existing code, and reverting to a couple of key phrases, which I've identified in my letter, would improve that section as well. We support the new, more protective regulations for docks, piers, bulkheads, and other shore armoring, and the new emphasis on protection for forage fish habitat. We, however, would be very disappointed if any of these protections were rolled back as part of this update. We think the HPA rules need a section on gravel mining in small streams. The existing code covers gravel removal in large harbors or large rivers, but they don't really cover the small coho streams. There are a lot of these permits issued, and the existing and proposed WACs don't really have any provisions for it. We'd like to see that added. We have many more comments, but I'll close by complimenting the WDFW staff, particularly Randy, who's shown enormous patience and perseverance throughout this entire process. Again, SRSC and the tribes we represent recommend the HPA rules be updated, but not without making a few changes that are necessary to adequately protect fish. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Calhoun, you're the last one.
I am. Hi, my name is Susie Calhoun. I'm on the board of directors of Sound Action, but I'm here today as a private citizen who lives on an island in Puget Sound and is intimately connected with the shoreline. And I really want to take the big picture view as I am the closing speaker, and that is to remind all of you and the department that as you move forward to the revisions to the code or to the regulations, of what the purpose of the department and the commission is, which is primarily to protect fish and fish habitat. So as you're making those changes, I hope that you'll use that lens to look at a proposed change to see if indeed it's going to do a better job of protecting fish and fish habitat. I have worked throughout my life for government. I'm a private consultant. I've worked at the local, the state, and the state level. And what I have observed over those years is that when an organization becomes has a permitting function, sometimes that mission gets lost because the purpose then becomes to get the permits out and to facilitate development. And what we know from the decline of the fish species in Puget Sound, that primary role that I'm asking you as a citizen, your primary role is to protect the commons for all of us. And right now, we're not doing a very good job. And I know that it's not just habitat degradation, but that is a big part of the fact of why Puget Sound is in decline. So if we all do our job better, and we remember that protecting fish and fish habitat is the primary purpose of these regulations, I think we'll go the other, we can turn this around. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes the public hearing on this topic. I want to thank you all. I think you all did a very impressive job articulating your viewpoints. It was some of the best public comment we've heard. We get it. We're not sure when we're going to be making a decision on the rules, but you'll be informed, never fear. So thank you again for all your hard work, working with our staff to develop this immense rule package. Thanks again. Okay.